There's a lot of things going on.
This is a very zany kind of game.
It was ahead of its time.
It's really clever what they've done.
It's tense, but it's very brain melty.
It's kind of a mix of everything I love in trick taking.
Hey everyone, welcome to Trick Talkers, your favorite podcast about trick takers, shedders, climbers, and other card games. I'm Johnny.
I'm Ryan.
And I'm Patrick.
And tonight's episode is brought to you by Ryan Hopkins, our one and only patron. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you, Ryan.
So I'm back this week, and I wanted to start off with, I'm calling it housekeeping, but it's not really housekeeping. These aren't corrections, but I didn't get to weigh in on the top five thematic games, so I just wanted to say what I would have said if I had been present in the episode. I thought that the notable ones missing from the list for me were Catchy, which is a two-player trick taker where you're trying to lure a cat with string and fish and what's the other one? Mice, right? Things that cats like. And Bottle Imp, which we've talked about on, I think, our first episode, which I think is very thematic. It's based on a story by Robert Louis Stevenson and Frank Zhu. So those were three that I would have mentioned. I just want to give them honorable mentions. I don't know what you guys think of those, but I think they're very thematic.
They're honorable indeed.
Well, we knew the bottle imp will come back to haunt because the imp always comes back into the picture. You know, like I said, maybe I've said on a previous episode, that game was on my shelf, got moved on, and then reappeared on my shelf. So it always has a way of wiggling its back onto a list or back into a collection.
I will also say those three games aren't necessarily... Frank Zhu is pretty high up there, but... those three games aren't necessarily three of my top games. I just think they're three of the most, the games where the theme and the mechanics just tie in very well to each other.
Right. They're quite catchy.
Yeah. speaking of cats, our main topic today is Nine Lives, also known as Catty, especially to Patrick.
Especially to me. Okay. So... Catty / Nine Lives is a game that is made of, the deck is made of 3 to 4 suits, depending on the player count, with the suit colour being on the back of the cards. That's what makes this game quite unique. So when the cards are held, everyone can see what suit is held by which player. You're going to deal 9 cards to each player in turn order. And players are going to bid how many tricks they think they will take in the round. And in the case of Nine Lives, they use a rug, and that shows on the rug 1 to 4 tricks, but it also shows 5 to 8 tricks, and I'll move on to why that is the case in a moment. You may bid horizontally. To clarify, there are little wooden cats or cats, depending on which version you've got. And you use them to place bids, so you can put the cat horizontally on the mat, if you like, the bidding mat for an exact bid, or you can place the cat vertically if you're not sure. So, for example, an exact bid, you might say, okay, well, I'm going to take 4 tricks. And if you're not sure and you want to speculate a little bit and make it a bit easier for yourself, you might say, okay, well, I'm going to take between 3 and 4 tricks. Which is going to be equivalent to 7 and 8 tricks because of the way that the bidding works. Nine Lives. I keep defaulting to Catty. You'll learn why later. Nine Lives is a must-follow game, so the purple suit is the trump suit, and the highest card in the trump suit wins. If there is no trump played to the trick, then the highest card of the lead suit wins, as you'd find in a normal trick-taking game. The winner of the trick takes one of the cards that is not their own from the trick and puts it back into their hand, which makes the game quite spicy. And they will lead the next trick, so they get a choice as to what card they take. The round ends when at least one player runs out of cards after the winner takes a card back into their hand. If you hit your horizontal exact bid, you'll score 4 points. If you hit your speculative bid, the bid that you put on where you place your cat vertically across a couple of numbers, you will score 2 points. And if you miss your bid, you'll lose points equal to the number of spaces that you were off by. for physical spaces. So, for example, if you bid three and only take two, you'll score minus one. And you're going to play four rounds, or once one player reaches nine or more points, the game will end. And where I said earlier about the bidding track, just to clarify, I said that there were multiple numbers on the track. So you're going to go from one to four, that's on the rug, but also in nine lives, players can loop rounds. So for example, a one could also be a five, and an eight could also be a four. And so the game's going to play out in this interesting way where players are going to loop on the score track when they take tricks.
Yeah, it's almost like almost reminds me of Monster Trick. If you bid 1/5 and you end up taking two tricks, you just need to win enough to loop back around.
Yeah, so it's kind of this interesting quirk. So you've got the spice in that perspective. You also got the spice where you the winner of the trick takes a card back that's not their own. Of the card that's played to the trick. So what do we all think about the production and the artwork?
I think the production's pretty good. I know some people were complaining about the card quality, saying it was they were stiff and difficult to shuffle. I don't know if there's some variance in the production, but I didn't have any issue shuffling. I don't sleeve cards, as you guys know, and they shuffled perfectly fine for me. I think I've heard a couple people that initially said that they were very stiff, that they kind of softened up after a few plays. So, the card quality seems really good. I'll be honest, I'm not a big fan of the artwork. I don't really like
the style. We're talking about nine lives here.
Yes, not Caddy. I love the artwork on Caddy. I will say that I feel like a combination of the two games is probably the ideal, because I do think the rug and the wooden meeples are really nice from nine lives. But I like the art style and the artwork specifically from Caddy, I think, is a little bit nicer.
Yeah.
So I will say the wooden upgrade for the cat meeples is very, very nice. Even my wife, who doesn't super care about that stuff, was like, yeah, those cardboard pieces are garbage. I'm glad you got the wooden ones.
Because wooden cats are easier to look after as well than real cats, so that's a bonus.
And what's nice is if you get those wooden cats, you can use the cardboard cats as sort of the player pieces in front of you. Because the game comes with these little circular cardboard tokens that have like the cat's face on it that you're supposed to put in front of the player to show like what player color they are, which isn't as cool as having the actual cat. So if you have the wooden ones, you put those on the bidding track and then you keep the cardboard one in front of you.
It's a good idea. I don't think we thought of that. I think we just left it to each player to remember who they were, and we didn't really it was a group of casual gamers. I think this was the second trick taker I've taught them, and probably their second ever game that they've been taught. And they were nobody was really looking at somebody else's bid trying to push certain people over that much. There was a little bit of that, but yeah.
Well, I can only speak to it from a perspective of the production, what I've seen of Nine Lives, and obviously Caddy, as I have a copy of Caddy. So essentially, the production for me, my opinion is that the wooden cats look great from Nine Lives, having looked at them and seen pictures of them on BGG, and based on, what other people are saying, like yourselves. Look great, and I think the rug is really, really thematic. So Board Game Tables have knocked it out of the park in that regard. I much prefer the artwork on Caddy, like you do. I personally feel it has more cultural relevance to Japan. The game was designed by Taki Shinjawa, and I just like the style. It's quite cartoony, quite anime-ish. In a sense, in a weird kind of way. And I like the fact that, the Trump suit is all cats and the other suits are mice. And also that you've got like the top two cards in the Trump suit. You've got this queen and king cats. So I thought it's quite really novel, really fun. Although in the Caddy version, you only get cubes for bidding, and you only get cubes to denote your player color. And the bidding track are these lumps of cheese. And I have to say that you might be right in terms of some weird kind of way to Frankenstein the two could be ideal. But, you know, I couldn't justify having two copies of essentially the same game. So I, in the end, I just went with Catty. So, yeah.
You just casually went with Catty.
Casually. It wasn't casually. It was a, took me a long time to, many, many, many moons to acquire a copy. And you guys might recall it was a bit of a weird one because I sort of used to say, oh, you know, guys, I've been having dreams about Catty. You know, somebody sold it to me in the back of a shop in Japan when I was there. That was a dream I had. That isn't a true story. Kind of strange, right? You know, you're in deep into the hobby when you're having those kind of dreams. In the end, it became a reality, so it was worth it, you know. But there we go. A weird one. But just an interesting perspective on the difference between the two productions, having come from it from a Catty perspective.
I think the ultimate edition will be the Itchy and Scratchy remake.
Yeah, the Tom and Jerry. what do you think of the production, Ryan?
I mean, I think I've shared the sentiments with both of you. If you could Frankenstein mash them together, it'd be a perfect addition. The chunky wooden cat meeples are perfect. The one thing with the cards in Nine Lives, I know the ones and the sevens are kind of close to each other. The seven has like a little cut in it. So when you have a one and a seven in your hand together, you can tell the difference. But if you're not dealt both, I have been in a couple games where people have had that question and not been 100% sure which one it is.
Right. Are they a different cat breed, though? A different image, I guess.
Yeah, it is a different image, but the problem is, I mean, the cat's in the middle of the cards. If you're holding your cards together and you just fan to see the numbers, you're not going to see the cat.
Right, okay, so, yeah, but I guess you're not in a situation like in Kanaloa. Is that more extreme where you have to say Tiki's up?
Yeah, Kanaloa is way more extreme.
Okay, all right, cool.
Yeah, I actually just had to look up because I couldn't remember. I could sort of see that. I think the seven doesn't look very much like a one to me, but I could see how that could, if you didn't have them side by side, how that could be a little bit confusing.
Yeah. And I mean, although I gave us a lovely rundown of the rules, one of the rules that's commonly misunderstood is negative points for bidding. And Ryan explained it beautifully earlier. So I hopefully can do the same again on when we're on air.
Yeah. Going to put me on the spot here. Yeah,
no pressure.
So, you know, what he is referring to is when you try and score your points at the end of the round. In the Nine Lives rule book, it refers to remind you that the scoreboard or the scoring track wraps from 4 to 5. However, when you're calculating the amount of negative points you're going to get, you don't consider wrapping a round. So what I mean by that, hopefully you can sort of visualize this as I explain it, is if you bid one trick in the round, which again could be 5, but let's just say you put your cat on the 1/5 space, and at the end of the round you took 4 tricks. In normal gameplay, you only need one more trick to wrap around from 4 to get back to 5, so you'd think, oh, well, I only lose 1 point. However, that's not the case. You always count the physical spaces on the rug from where your cube is to where your bidding piece is. So if you took 4 tricks and you bid 1, you'd have to count back down from 4 to 1, so you'd be losing 3 points.
Yeah. So you essentially always lose the maximum number of points between the possible bids at the space that you bid and the number of tricks that you won.
Exactly.
Also, I don't think it was mentioned, but there's a bit of blocking that people can do. Not necessarily intentionally, because you don't really know when you're bidding what other people are going for, but there are a limited number of spaces in front of each bid. There's 2 sides of the rug, and when you place your cat, it blocks that spot. So if you place your cat on the 2 to 3 space on one side, and somebody else puts their cat on the 2 space, somebody couldn't bid 2 to 3 anymore. Somebody could bid exactly 3 on the opposite side, or they could bid 3 to 4. So depending on the order in which you're bidding, you can sometimes not be able to get the bid space that you really think that you're going to be able to hit based on your hand.
And I actually think that's one of the very few negatives I have about this game, is that in combination of not having a 0 bid option. When you're playing a 4-player game and you're the 4th person to bid, you're just stuck with whatever's left for you. And you don't really have a choice or a say in what you wanted to bid, whether that's what you wanted to bid or not. So all of a sudden you look at it and it's the difference between taking one or four tricks, because maybe two players did a 2-3 and then another person did one. So you're trying to decide, okay, well, this hand I was actually thinking I'm going to get three tricks, so am I going to do one or four? And you're just sort of guessing, and it's not really a good feeling. Because if you end up hitting it, sure, like, yeah, you worked for it, you made your hand work out in the end, but it's not what you originally wanted to bid. Because in most bidding games, anybody can typically bid whatever number they want. The same amount of people can have the same number of bids.
Sorry. I just wanted to say, to weigh in on that, we had this conversation on the BGG forums, and in terms of, because there was this possible variant where, you know, if you came in last place, you on the next round, you were the first to bid. And we talked about bidding order specifically. And I know there are some folks that believe, and this is via, you know, through the voice of James Nathan, to quote, but he's basically saying that there's an argument that bidding first is a disadvantage because you don't have the information of what other people bid and the knowledge about their hand. You sort of may be able to infer from that. So there's reasons to go early, I guess, but that you could also argue there's some reasons to go later as well. And because I was originally in the position of the camp where, oh, surely the people who go first kind of, you know, can call all the shots. But it's just interesting to see on the other side of the coin, there are some people who believe actually, yeah, and I suppose this is probably more poignant for someone who's going at the very start of the round as well, in terms of going first or not the very first player.
Yeah, and I think there's other mitigating factors too. So I completely agree with that. If you're only left with the one and the four, first of all, you've got some information on what other people are going for. So that can help you make your decision on how likely you are to either hit one or four, which are on the extreme ends of the rug. The other thing is, in order for your options to be so few, multiple people have to bid a range, which means that the most points that they're going to get if they win are only 2 points. So the stakes are very low in each individual round. And the most negative that you can ever go is 3. So even though you could be stuck in a position where you don't feel like you have a bid option that matches your hand, the stakes are very low that you're going to fall very far behind in that round because of it. And also, the suits are shown on the back of the card. So you have actually quite a bit of information to try to manipulate how a hand goes by trying to play things that people are offsuited in, or trying to specifically not play things that people are offsuited in. And because you're also picking up a card at the end of the trick, you can start picking up more. You can start picking up cards that will help you get closer to your goal. So I think there's a lot of mitigation of that. I'm the last person and I only have between these two options. It never felt bad in our game anyways.
Yeah, coming back into suit when you've been off suit, or taking a suit that someone else is now off suited in and now you're back on suit with it. There's all sorts of interesting interdynamics at play here. And I do like, you know, that's one thing I do really like about this game. It adds to the spice level at the table in regards to just having that dynamic where the card's not gone for good, because that winner can always just pull that card back and potentially then use it to win the next trick, knowing everybody else, you know, is now off suit potentially, or, you know, all these interesting scenarios. What do you think on it, Ryan, and with the what we're saying about the, you know, the cards coming back into your hand?
No, I think it opens up a lot of interesting decisions, because if you have the 9, which is the highest card in a suit, you know, you more than likely are going to win with that. So you play it. Everybody else usually plays their lower numbers because they want to keep their high numbers to then win a later trick. And then it's causing the player who's winning to take a lower number back into their hand. And it's like, well, on one hand, you might actually be helping that player because maybe they wanted a low number because they're about to hit their bid or get close to it and they want to stop winning tricks. But then they might actually want the higher numbers. So the choices that all the players have to make in the trick becomes really clever, besides just the lead player. Because in most trick-taking games, I shouldn't say most, but there are some, where when you play out the highest card in a suit and it's must fall, everyone's like, okay, well, you're guaranteed to win this trick. doesn't really matter. I'll toss out whatever. But in this one, what you toss out absolutely can matter. As you said, putting somebody else back in suit potentially.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, it forces you to kind of, I guess you could play without doing this, but I think it somewhat forces you, if you want to play well, to pay attention to what's in other people's hands. Normally, you don't have any information just by looking at the back of somebody's hand. So I think that's a really interesting aspect to this game.
Yeah, and that's certainly one of the unique twists that make this game different from a lot of others, is just knowing the suits that people have.
Yeah, I did not think I was going to like it. I thought it was going to be too much information. Like, oh, it's too easy to know that you can play this card and that nobody will be able to follow. But I think because of the picking up of cards at the end of a trick, it makes it, it just worked in a way that I didn't expect it to.
Raises it above the level of a standard trick taker. I hate to use that terminology, but where, yeah, you've got the suits on the backs, you've got the taking back a card for the winner of the trick, and you've got the looping of the bidding, or wrapping around the bid rug, if you like. All these little interplays and twists that are in the game kind of make it, raise it a level beyond, just another average trick taker.
Yeah. You know, one thing we didn't mention while talking about the production, the backs of the cards, or the suits in general, are color-coded, but also symbol. They all have a unique symbol for colorblindness. I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah, so the backs of the cards have, besides just the color, it shows the actual suit. So, like, the red suit is a mouse, and on the back of the card, it also has those, I guess it's multiple, so mice going across it. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I do think I guess this is a different game, but there's a game called Luge, spelled L-U-Z, that's also a Taiki Shinzawa game, that has the suits on the back of the cards as well. And they do the similar idea with having the different symbols. So I think just in general, whenever there's suits on the back of the card, that has to be like the first thing you think of, is making sure that you also put the suits on there. So it's good on board game tables to make sure that they kept that in here when they remade this edition.
Yeah, I believe they do it in Catty as well, but I can't remember off the top of my head. But, I mean, the one folks are most likely to find, I guess, is Nine Lives. So, I mean, that's the main thing they've considered, people who are colorblind. So, in terms of success at the tabletop, how are we finding it? How are we rating it within our groups in terms of, how well it's gone down? I know, in my case, haven't yet played it with four. I think I played it with three players. So, we took a color suit out. And I guess the feeling might be different because obviously you've still got the same amount of spaces available on the bidding track. So your ability to get shut out of certain bids is less so with three players, just because obviously you've got more availability of the numbers. But it did happen. I think we really enjoyed it. I don't think it's one of my favorite trick takers, but certainly better than many I have played historically, just because of all the twists and the room for maneuverability with the plays. I do think that I would like to try it at four player and see how we go. And sorry to disappoint, but it's certainly one that Catty's certainly one that's going to be staying in my collection for the foreseeable future. What about you guys?
Yeah, I've only gotten it to the table with one group. It was four players. Like I said, it's the group that I play with, that my wife and I play with, that it's another couple that are non-gamers. We've played Fool, Masked Men with them. They've enjoyed both of those. So this is the third game that I've introduced them to. And everybody really liked it. It's like you, it's not going to make my top 10, probably ever. And they really enjoyed it. I liked it. It actually felt to me like a great option for a beginner bidding game, especially because you have the information of the card backs. I think that it's a great game to kind of teach the concepts of not just bidding, but also of short suiting and trump. And I think it's almost like, instead, if you don't want to play like with open hands, to kind of try to explain certain things to people. Well, now you have information in front of everybody the whole time, and people can really start to, it can start to click for people about how to play into people's short suits and things like that. So it really felt like a really good thing to add to the list of games I would bring out for people that haven't played a lot of Trick Takers before.
Are you in the same boat, Ryan? Are you saying, you know, in your opinion, is this a game for beginners, or do you see there's some scope for veterans as well? And just curious to see what your thoughts are.
No, I think it fits both groups really well. I agree with Johnny 100%, actually, with all of the ideas of being able to see the suits, understanding short suiting, knowing that there's always the same trump suit every round. The bidding track is the only part, I guess, that would be a little more advanced. And I'm only saying this because, again, I'm going to re-go back to Lose, which was another one of Taiki's games that came out before Caddy, the original one, and before Nine Lives, of course, where it's sort of the exact same game without a wrapping bidding system and without taking cards back into your hand. Of course, there's a separate twist. I'm getting into the weeds here, right. But you don't see your hand either. Your hand's faced out. You see other players' hands.
Right.
So that's another crazy thing that you're introducing to people, which I guess could be perceived as being a little bit more difficult. But I think, to sort of play devil's advocate a little bit there, I just think that one's easier because you're seeing even more cards. Sure, you don't know yours, but you know more cards at the table than you would in a normal game when you're only seeing your own hand, on top of seeing the backs mm-hmm. of your suits. But again, I digress there and come back to Nine Lives and still say that this game has done well at my table. Before Nine Lives was available to show some of my friends to see if they wanted to back on the Kickstarter, we just used my copy of Lose, and then I printed out a score track and made that work. I think it was like 3 or 4 people ended up backing it after we played a couple times, so it clearly was a hit. I will say the more I play this, though, the less excited I am about it. The ideas and the twists in this game are very unique. When you take each of them individually, there's a trick-taking game right within there. Having the suits on the back of the cards is a trick-taking game right there. Having a bidding track that wraps around is a trick-taking game right there. But mashing them all together makes it really unique. But is that uniqueness enough to keep it around? Is it actually a good trick-taker? Is it very, very interesting to where after that initial mind-blowing, you know, discovery wears off, is it still just a solid trick taker? I'm not sure. So I think that might be a hot topic and a hot debate there. But that's just kind of how it is for me at this point. I feel the same way about Cat in the Box. And again, I know I'm sort of going off on another game, but those are games that have really good initial, like, oh my God, and wow moments. When you first show it to people and you teach them and explain, like, after you win the trick, you get to take a card back into your hand and you can see the suits, so you know what you're going to be trying to take back. It's like, oh, that's so cool, that's so clever. And then you talk about bidding and exact or not exact, and then wrapping around, you're like, well, that's so crazy, I've never seen that before. But then you play it a few times and you're like, but that replayability, the wow factor sort of wore off, and is it still interesting?
I sort of agree with you, but I think that the initial wow factor and then it maybe collecting dust on your shelf is more of it says more about how spoiled for choice we are, because I think if you had just a handful of options, I think you would continually come back, and I think there's enough there to dig into. You know, in terms of replayability, I think just the fact that they're random deals and there's bidding, every hand's going to play out differently, even though the mechanisms are the same from game to game. So I think that these games all have inherent replayability, but I think the real issue is there something that does what Nine Lives does better, or does what some of the individual aspects do better? And I think the answer is most definitely yes. So I can see why this would lose a little bit of steam after a few plays, and you might move on to something else. I did want to also just comment on how the bidding is the one thing that makes this maybe a little less beginner friendly. And I agree with you there. And the reason that doesn't turn me off from using this as a beginner game is, like I said before, the stakes are extremely low. The scoring from round to round, and the negative scoring in particular, is the swings are not huge. So even if somebody, unlike in like a game like Spades, if somebody misses their bid by a lot, they're not going to dig themselves a hole so deep that they're no longer having fun. And they'll start to get better at bidding as the game goes, and they'll still be in it.
So I actually want to play a huge devil's advocate there, because if somebody manages to hit their bid and in its exact bid in this game, they're going to score 4 points. And if somebody who missed their bid loses 3 points, that's a difference of 7 points. And the game only goes till somebody hits 9 points. So you could be very far behind. Now, granted, of course, if you're at zero, you can't go below zero. So if it's the first round, somebody gets 4 points and somebody loses 3 points, they're still at zero. So they're only 4 points behind. But I won't disagree that it can seem low stakes. But I do think I want to mention that the score differences are big, even though it's only a single digit numbers. That still makes it big when somebody's scoring 4 points and somebody else is getting zero.
Yeah, yeah. If you're both hitting the extremes, for sure, then the swing could be big. We didn't see that much in our game. So, and everybody was a beginner. So I felt like the people that missed their bid were usually only missing it by one or two. And it was, nobody really pulled ahead. Nobody was hitting their exact bid round after round while other people were hitting negative. So the game was actually pretty tight in our case, but I can't see how it wouldn't always turn out that way.
Yeah, it's a bit less when you look at Ghosts of Christmas and with Dwas, in terms of missing your bids, I don't think this is that particularly punitive, as you guys were saying. And just to take a little step back, when we talk about playing the game and replayability and, you know, games that has it got the staying power? I mean, I suppose if you look at the bigger philosophical question, you could probably apply that to most games in the collection. There are only certain games that really will come out over and over again. And a lot of them will come out, you know, occasionally on a rainy day. Or to play devil's advocate a little bit, stereotypical marriage, you know, it's great at first when you first meet, and then, you know, later on down the line, you get so used to each other that people get into bad habits and things don't, you know, aren't quite as fresh and awe-inspiring as they were from day one. That's putting it politely. For me, you guys, obviously, you know how much of an effort I went to track down Catty. You'll probably recall me sort of crying out for it in the the PGC Discord group, and how I would say, "Oh, is anybody because people thought I was bonkers at first trying to find this game, this Catty, because even Taiki himself, Taiki Shinzawa, said, "Look, you know, I've only got one copy and that's mine." So it took me months and months and months to find it, 15 or so Google tabs every day. Searching Japanese, scouring the websites, looking for Catty on any possible auction site or anywhere in Japan I could possibly find it.
Trying to get Jelly Jelly to reprint the game.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. No, I'm glad you mentioned that, Ryan. Thanks for reminding me. I approached the CEO of Jelly Jelly Games and we had a bit of back and forth, and there was a suggestion that they might be susceptible to reprinting Catty, and then the conversation kind of died, and then I went and cried into my pillow. Not really,
don't lie,
but sort of thought, keep it a secret between us and the listeners.
He definitely cried. He just almost cried into his pillow.
Almost cried into my pillow. I think my the missus sort of said, well, you never get that emotional about me. So there you go. But anyway, so I got Catty, and it's going to stay in the collection because it was so hard to find. And to be honest, like with anything, the best part of getting Catty was hunting for Catty and sort of receiving it. I'm kind of in the same boat in terms of it's not going to be one of my favorite trick takers, but it's been my favorite one that I've hunted down, and it's kind of going to hold a special place because it's, you know, really hard to find. Whereas if I had 9 lives, I'm not sure whether I would be as bothered about retaining it or not. probably keep it for another year or two and see how many plays I get out of it.
So I've seen some, I don't know if you guys have ever seen the like specialty. I think there was like a Lord of the Rings one recently where they sell an uncut sheet of all the cards so you can like frame it and put it up on your wall. And you could kind of do something like that with your copy. If you decide it's not worth playing, you can just lay out all the cards onto a mat and frame it and put it up on your wall.
That's sacrilege, Johnny. I've got to play it occasionally. I mean, Tyke would be ashamed.
Yeah, I'd force you to give it to me before you did that.
Yeah. I'd have a lot of people begging me for my copy. So no, I really like it from an art perspective and what it offers and what it claims it can do and be. Whether I can make that into a reality at four players, you know, remains to be seen through repeat plays, hopefully. So that was my finding the Holy Grail. The toughest card game that I've had to find to date.
You know, Ryan, you mentioned Cat in the Box, and I just want to say that was another one that I thought was extremely thematic that was missing from the list. You just reminded me. I just wanted to give that another honorable mention. The cat games, they'll always have.
Yeah, you need one more honorable mention. You could have your own five list here if you'd like.
I could have my own five, right? Yeah. I need to figure out.
Yeah, well, you got to the end of this episode to come up with one more.
Well, so. I'll try to come up with one more. But you guys had several on your list were on my list. So what I did is my buddy and I were my co-host on Train Shuffling. We were driving back from New York after our trip this weekend. And I actually had thought that the episode was published because I was like on Anchor and I said, they already put that one out, and I didn't realize it was just a draft. But we decided to take a sneak peek, and we listened to it. And as we got to each section, I paused it and was like, here's what, like, when you guys were talking about Boast or Nothing, I was like, here are the things that I would want to say about it. And then we unpaused it and listened to see how much of the same things.
Paused it and swore at the music player, right? And you thought, wow, hang on, a music player? Where did that come from? At the radio or whatever device you used, and we're just thinking, damn it, I hate those guys, they've missed out my essential piece here. And then
I think there was very little that I would have added to that discussion. I think you guys were pretty much on point with how I felt about it, but when you got to the top five thematic games, I had to pause it and make my list, and several of them were crossovers. Schadenfreude, it was funny because I said from a name perspective, it's very, the name is very thematic to what you're trying to do to the other players.
Skanderfraud, yeah?
Skanderfraud. Oh my God, you drove my friend nuts. He speaks German.
No, I'm sure I did. Yeah, I knew what I was doing. Yeah.
When you said it at the end of the episode, he's like, he's doing that on purpose, right? And I was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Pushes buttons, that one.
But one other thing that I want to mention when you guys talked about roulette taking, I was, when you guys were describing the mat, so I've never played roulette at a casino, but I've played craps, and I was like, the mat looks and sounds like a craps betting table. And my friend was like, well, they couldn't use craps because think about what the name of that game would be. It'd be the crap taking game.
Well, yeah.
So then we spent some of the ride trying to figure out how the crap taking game would play to see if we could come up with a sequel to the roulette taking game. We didn't come up with anything.
I was going to buy the crap taking game, but it got shit reviews.
I guess I asked for that one.
I've done that. Yeah. I was going to say, in terms of games that felt similar though, craps aside, Johnny. Similar games. We talked about Luz, or Luz. I should know. I speak a bit of Spanish. Luz. What about other games that are similar? So one of the ones I can think of is Color Gangsters, which has also got suits on the back of the cards as well. Obviously, quite a different game in the way it plays out, but they're going with that kind of concept in similarity that it shares with Catty. Or Nine Lives. I keep saying Catty. Of course, I'm biased.
I think at this point, everybody knows what we're talking about for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, Color Gangsters, the reason why it's a similar enough game is because it has the suits on the back of the cards, which I personally think is a great way to introduce trick-taking to anyone. If they have never played a trick-taker in their life, just grab any deck of cards that you have that has the colors on the back and just play a regular old trick taker, but with the suits showing. So people can understand when someone's about to be out of a suit and then short suiting and stuff like that. So I just always think that's great. That's what I would do like with my lose copy for a while whenever I was showing some of my friends around here.
Yeah, that's a great point, because that was one of the things I liked about Nine Lives, was that it helps reinforce those concepts. And I hadn't thought about just taking out some of the extra rules and just playing it as a standard must follow trick taker with no hooks other than the suits on the back.
Yeah, I actually, so the story that sort of started all that was trying to teach the crew to somebody and never played a trick taker in their life, had only really ever heard of Euchre, but again, never played it. And we tried playing a round of mission one of the crew quest for Planet Nine. So one card has to be won by one person. We played the first mission through and they still had no idea what they were doing. I was like, okay, let's take a step back. And then that's when I just pulled out the lose cards and said, okay, here's the things. You could see everybody's suits. And then we just sort of slowly played through it, and it helped them and it made it click a little bit quicker. And ever since then, I had just been sort of doing that to anybody else that I'm introducing trick taking to.
I think that's a really good idea. I guess one thing you could do as well, as an alternative, if you don't own loose, is just grab like four decks of different playing cards with different backs on them, right? And then choose a suit to be a specific color, and then you can kind of create your own little trick taking game where you've got the suits on the back of the clock, you know, where you all agree what the suits are. So if you wanted to recreate that feeling but you don't own lose, then there's another way of doing it.
There's also Nine Lives is available. It's readily available from board game tables.
Oh, well, yeah. Speak of the devil. Yeah.
Or if you happen to be somebody who has neither Nine Lives nor lose, and you happen to have four different colored opaque backed card sleeves, you can sleeve a deck and put each suit in a different color. Another one with cards with suits on the back is Scharfschotten. Or Scharfschotten. My friend's going to probably tell me how I butchered that pronunciation. Bit of a hard one to find, but when we're talking about other games that have card suits on the back, that's a really good one.
Yeah, one that I think I want to mention here, because I know we talk about this game a lot on this podcast, is Pups. And while it's sort of in a roundabout way, can have a similar feel to this game, is for the variable number of tricks that are in a round. So in Nine Lives, the round will end when one player runs out of cards, but other players still might have cards in their hand. If you don't win a trick, you don't pick a card back up. So you don't actually know when the round will end. I mean, you can have some idea because you'll see how many cards are left in players' hands, but Pups does a similar thing because you could play one or two cards into the trick. It gives that sense of not being too sure of, it's not just, oh, seven cards in hand, seven tricks, that's it. It's variable, which is a really interesting piece of gameplay from Nine Lives, from Pups, and from another game, Dog Tag Trick. And those, I think, are three really good examples of games if you want to try and play a trick taker that messes around with the number of tricks in a round.
And another variable round trick taker is Fool. Because of the fact that you could miss rounds if you're the fool.
You're the fool. Yeah, I'll do that. One of the ones that wasn't on our list was, I wanted to mention, it's trick taking, is Plotters Inc. or Mit List Untuck. And again, you know, your German friend Johnny will probably say I've absolutely butchered that pronunciation.
You know, he listens to all of our episodes, so we reference him a lot whenever we say German words.
Sorry, what's his name?
Eric.
Eric. Oh, Eric will have me for that one. So Plotters Inc., I'm only mentioning it because I believe, I haven't played it yet, by the way, just a caveat, and you guys will probably know the answer, but I believe that, you know, the winner of the trick can take a couple of cards, albeit they'll go towards their scoring, and the loser of the trick gets to, or the person who played the lowest non-trump card gets to take cards as well. So in a similar way to Catty, you've still got the decision space of taking back cards from the trick, albeit you can't reuse them in future tricks.
Yeah, I think the way the scoring works out makes it feel very different, despite the fact that you're also taking cards from the trick.
Yeah, just kind of it was a stretch, but just for that crossover. Yeah.
I was just saying that to you not to dispute what you're saying, but because you hadn't played it before, it feels very different.
Makes sense.
Well, I think with the taking cards back in your hands, the ones that actually do this really well are shedding climbing games. And that's why it's interesting for Nine Lives to be a trick taker. It isn't a shedding game. You're not really trying to get out faster than anybody. But games like Hachi Train, Linko, and Scout are all ones where when you play cards, you have the potential ability to get cards back into your hand. And you're typically doing that because you're trying to meld a better hand to then ultimately be able to go out again faster. So if you like the idea of being able to take more cards back after it's been played, those are three great options.
I think Hachi Train is one I particularly am fond of with that mechanic where you're taking back cards because, you know, and certainly in terms of the quantity of cards, you're playing cards and literally picking them all up to try and get out faster. So, you know, really, really, perhaps a really good example of a game that does that more so than my Plotters example earlier. Anyway, this is the part where we say we have a Patreon. And
with conviction.
We have a Patreon. Obviously, we are definitely passionate about trick takers, and we're going to produce the show either way. We're so touched by all the feedback and the fact that everyone's listening. And if you'd like to join Ryan Hopkins as a Patreon backer and support the show financially, you can head on over to patreon.com/tricktalkers. That would be very much appreciated. I know we're grateful for anyone who does wish to contribute. And if not, we shall certainly keep talking.
Yep. And we appreciate you anyways.
We do. Even with my, I'm sure Eric appreciates listening, even with my butchered German pronunciations as well. So that's good. So thanks for listening. We've been Trick Talkers. And this is the part where Ryan points you to the questions, comments, and recommendations.
Well, you can first head on to Twitter and reach us at Trick Talkers, or you can email us at tricktalkers@gmail.com.
All right, well, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Good night.
Bye.